This is Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's podcast, episode number 111. I'm your host, Jan Irvin. This episode is an interview with David Harriman, part one, titled The Philosophic Corruption of Physics and the Logical Leap, and is being released on Monday, May 2, 2011. My interview with David was recorded on May 1, 2011. David Harriman earned his master's degree in physics from the University of Maryland and his master's in philosophy from Claremont Graduate University. He has worked as an applied physicist, and he is the editor of Journals of Ayn Rand. His book, The Logical Leap, Induction in Physics, presents Leonard Peikoff's theory of induction as it applies to the physical sciences. Recently, he has co-founded Falling Apple Science Institute with Tom Van Dam, a nonprofit that is developing a unique science curriculum based on the inductive method. And this is our first interview since the Free Your Mind conference in Philly, and I had a great time there and met some incredible people. And if you haven't seen my presentation there yet, it is available on the Gnostic Media website. And donations. This episode is dedicated to Stephen, Hans, Duncan, Bridget, Paul, Kathleen, Arthur, Scott, Kim, Bram, Jeremy, James, John, Jason, Samuel, Christopher, Aaron, Yariv, and especially Randy. And I really can't thank each of you enough. I've had a major setback recently that's sort of thrown everything off. 2 weeks ago, my car engine blew up, and I've been having to come up with over $5,000 to get it fixed, and I really don't have it. So each one of you supporting this show and everything else here, well, I really can't say thank you enough. And right now, probably more than ever, I can use all the help and support I can possibly get. The show is run on donations and our website sales. This is not corporate media, but independent media in the truest sense of the words. And by donating or ordering one of the books or DVDs or the audio archives or getting a membership to the website to download the older podcasts, you help to continue this programming as well as helping to get us moving again. And I ask that you stop sending money every month to your local cable company, paying the corporate media to lie to you day in and day out. Instead, invest in your and everyone else's edification by donating and making interviews like this and projects like these happen, and not just here, but with all quality independent media. And upcoming shows next week will be part two with David Harriman, and after that, I have no idea what I'm going to bring up at this moment, but I guess you'll all be the first to know when it gets there. And you can support this program by going to the Gnostic Media website and ordering one of the books or DVDs or the Shehura members' audio archives, a t-shirt, a download membership, etc. We greatly appreciate it. And the views expressed by the authors and guests of this unprogram are their own and are not necessarily those held by myself, the host, or Gnostic Media. You can go to the website at GnosticMedia.com. That's GnosticMedia.com. You can contact me via the contact form on the website or directly at contact@GnosticMedia.com. Thanks for listening and thank you for your support. And here is my interview with David Harriman, The Philosophic Corruption of Physics and the Logical Leap. This is one of the most important and mind-blowing interviews we've done here to date. Enjoy part one with David Harriman. Thanks for your patience and support. David, welcome and good morning, and it's nice to have you on the Gnostic Media podcast. How are you doing today?
Great, and thank you for having me on the show.
I got to admit, David, I'm really excited to have you here, and why don't you start off by telling us a little bit about yourself, including your educational background and that sort of thing?
Sure. Well, my educational background is in physics and philosophy, and I'm all but dissertation in both subjects. And I went to University of Maryland back in the early 80s in physics, and then worked as a physicist for a number of years doing studies for the Air Force. And then I got... I got bored with that and realized that I needed to go back to what had interested me quite a bit when I was initially in college, which was philosophy of science. So I then went to graduate school in philosophy at Claremont Graduate University, and there I also made it to the dissertation stage, but not beyond that. And then after that, I began to work with Dr. Leonard Peikoff, who is Ayn Rand's intellectual heir. And then we got interested in exploring the nature of inductive reasoning by looking closely at the history of science, and that eventually led to the book that I published this last year, The Logical Leap, which is in essence a book on scientific method inducing principles of proper scientific method from the history of science.
So you were turned down for your dissertations in both physics and philosophy. How, in your opinion, does your work impact such a decision against your work?
Well, now, the two cases were a bit different, actually. In physics, what happened was my interest was in fundamental theory. But the further I got into graduate studies, it became clear to me that fundamental theory today is the manipulation of mathematical formalisms with very little physical understanding. And that was not of interest to me. It's not what I wanted to spend the rest of my life on. And as soon as I realized that, I basically dropped out. So I never actually submitted a dissertation in physics and had it turned down. Now, in philosophy, I did submit a dissertation proposal, which was turned down, and then years later, a complete dissertation that was also turned down. And there the issue was that my views are so different than what is going on in contemporary academic philosophy that I couldn't find any compromise that any way to work out with my committee a dissertation that they would be happy with and that I would be willing to write.
Wow.
And I mean, the major problem there is dissertations are really not supposed to be original work. They're more critical literature reviews. You're supposed to pick a narrow topic and then spend most of your dissertation talking about what other academics have said about the topic. And then, of course, if you look at the writings of those other academics, they mostly consist of talking about what other academics have said. So it's an infinite loop. And original ideas that offer some insight into reality are frowned on. So, no, I didn't get a very enthusiastic response from my dissertation committee for my work in philosophy of science.
How did you begin researching induction's role in the advancement of physics and chemistry?
Well, it started actually when I began to research just the history of science in order to get insights into scientific method. And one of the things I found was that when I really understood the history of the discovery process and how the ideas were arrived at, I found that I had a much deeper understanding of the science itself. I mean, when I began that research, I expected, well, I'm going to learn a lot of history here. Initially, the surprising thing to me was that I wasn't just learning history. I felt like I was learning the science for the first time. And after thinking about that, and I realized why that was true, I was actually identifying the inductive steps that lead from the observational evidence to these broad abstract ideas. And of course, they don't do that in science classes today. And then I found myself getting a lot of insight into scientific method by studying that history and being able to identify the steps in those discovery processes. And Leonard got interested, I mean, Dr. Peikoff got interested in that work, and I gave him a whole year-long course on the history of physical science. And we were, you know, exploring the epistemological implications of that material. And he came up with some brilliant original ideas on a theory of induction. And then I ended up writing the book on it.
So actually, and as you say in the introduction to the book, both he and you really contributed on the book, but you're accredited as the author and he just the introduction, really.
Right. Well, I mean, he actually wrote, I would say, most of chapter one. My job there was more copyated in his lectures. I mean, he came up with the original philosophic ideas, and I wrote up the presentation and the history. I mean, the reason I'm sole author on the book is because, I mean, when it came to the actual writing of it, I wrote 90% of the book, but the basic new philosophic ideas are his.
All right, I've got a quote for you from Norbert Wiener, and he says, "What I say about the need for faith in science is equally true for a purely causative world and for one in which probability rules. No amount of purely objective and disconnected observation can show that probability is a valid notion. To put the same statement in other language, the laws of induction cannot be established inductively. Inductive logic, the logic of Bacon, is rather something on which we can act than something which we can prove, and to act on it is a supreme assertion of faith. Science is a way of life which can only flourish when men are free to have faith." And that's end quote. And let me ask you this, can the laws of induction be established inductively?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, that's the only way they can be established. The philosophy is primarily the fundamental principles that guide our thinking and our actions. Well, they're very broad generalizations. Well, how can you get to those type of generalizations? Only by observing concretes, observational evidence, and generalizing from it. So the role of induction is the same in philosophy as it is in the special sciences. Now, what are the data sources that we use to arrive at principles of method and other principles in philosophy? Well, there's a couple. One is history. You know, Ayn Rand once said that history is the laboratory of philosophy. We look at the sorts of ideas and actions people have taken in the past, and we see the results. And, I mean, that is absolutely invaluable in coming up with the principles of philosophy. Now, the other major data source we have is our own personal experience. And part of that is introspection on our own thought processes and choices. And the rest of it is observing the people around us. We've all known people who adopted different ideas, made different kinds of choices, took different kinds of actions. and we see the results. So we have this huge observational data set from which to abstract philosophic principles. And that is an inductive process. So now this, I mean, the quote that you read, I'm not familiar with that philosopher, but that is straight out of David Hume. He's repeating what David Hume said. And Hume's idea there is that all we have in terms of observational data is a series of disconnected sensations. And nothing can be inferred from a series of disconnected sensations. I mean, the only thing we can say is that, well, sensation B followed sensation A in the past. So we're going to make a leap of faith and assume that in the future, sensation B will follow sensation A. But there's no basis for that on Hume's philosophy. That is just a wild guess that we find convenient. And that's why Hume ended as a total skeptic. I mean, Hume actually said that there was no possible way to justify any generalization. And then he went on to say, well, nobody can live like that, so we'll go ahead and use these generalizations anyway. So that's what Norbert Wiener here is repeating.
I was going to say regurgitating.
Yeah.
What is the importance of Aristotle as the father of logic, rejecting Plato, and inducing the theory of deduction?
Well, I mean, I would say in a nutshell, everything good goes back to Aristotle. Aristotle was the first to present a philosophy that was based on reality and reason. And he had a one-world metaphysics. The reality is the world of entities that we observe around us. And the way we come to know the nature of that world is by the use of reason, logic based on observation. And basically that foundation that he laid out is what later led to all the progress in science. So, I mean, Aristotle's role here couldn't be overstated. I mean, the reason people get confused about this sometimes is because, I mean, the scientific revolution is often said to be a rebellion against Aristotle because they overturned his physics and his astronomy. But of course, what's important about Aristotle was never his physics and astronomy. It's his epistemology, his ethics, his basic pro-reason, pro-life approach.
And on top of that is the father of logic.
Oh, yeah, right. I mean, he laid out the theory of deductive logic. So he got the whole subject started. Now, and interestingly, the first great physicist, Galileo, actually recognized this about Aristotle. You know, it's often some of Galileo's contemporaries accused him of being anti-Aristotelian. And Galileo actually took offense at that. And one of the things that he said late in his life was that Galileo regarded himself as more Aristotelian than the the academic scholastics of his time that claimed they were Aristotelians. You know, Galileo pointed out that, well, he had learned logic from Aristotle, and he had learned the role of sense perception in knowledge. And, I mean, everything he knew about method was ultimately based on Aristotle. And he even went on to say that if Aristotle had been brought back to life in the early 17th century, that Galileo was confident that Aristotle would take his point of view against the Aristotelian scholastics. So, and I think Galileo was absolutely right about that.
What is the importance of Galileo regarding the origins of modern physics?
Well, in my judgment, he's the first physicist. He was the first to conduct a mathematical and experimental study of motion and come up with laws of motion. And that is so fundamental to physics, and it laid the foundation for Newton later. So, I mean, I regard Galileo as the first great physicist. Now, it's a funny story. When Leonard Peikoff was in college, he took a course where the professor was discussing the history of physics, and Leonard asked the professor, who was the first physicist? And the professor said, there was no first physicist. And Leonard asked, well, then was the second physicist the first? And the professor said, yes. So, no, but my answer is straightforward to that question, that Galileo was the first great physicist. And for people who read my book, The Logical Leap, they'll see my reasons for that in Chapter 2.
All right, same question regarding Kepler. What is the importance of Kepler regarding the origins of modern physics?
Well, Kepler was the greatest astronomer of his era, that early 17th century. And he was absolutely brilliant and very original. He was the first to discover the correct theory of the solar system. I mean, his three laws of planetary motion. And Kepler realized what he had done. You know, it was more than just discovering the laws. He had taken a different approach, excuse me, a physical approach, where he was actually seeking to identify the fundamental physical cause of the planetary orbits. His book that he published in 1609 was actually entitled New Astronomy Based on Causes. So that was a real break from the past, because in the past, so many astronomers had simply been trying to come up with a mathematical scheme that would allow them to make predictions, but not come up with a physical theory. So, for example, prior to Kepler, all of the theories of the solar system used epicycles, so planets revolving around vacant points for no physical reason. Kepler eliminated all of that. And because he was committed to coming up with a physical causal theory, that is what actually enabled him to discover the correct laws of planetary motion. I cover that in Chapter 3 of my book, but it's a brilliant progression that he went through. And I was just going to mention, Galileo had come up with laws of terrestrial motion for the first time. Kepler had come up with the correct laws of planetary motion. And that really set the table for Isaac Newton, who then came along and created a whole new system of the world that integrated both realms. the celestial realm with the terrestrial realm, and came up with universal laws for the first time in the history of physics.
What did Ayn Rand have to say about reason and the study of physics?
Well, not very much, although there is an interesting statement in her first philosophic journal, which was written when she was in her late 20s. At that time, quantum physics had just been discovered, and there was a lot of talk about, of course, the implications of this statistical probabilistic theory that rejected causality. And so there's a passage in her early philosophic journal where she says, well, one of these days she has to get around to actually studying physics and seeing what they're talking about when they talk about how the physical world, is at bottom, unintelligible and non-causal. And she realizes that has to be nonsense, but she makes this comment that, well, that at some point she needs to find time to look into this nonsense. Now, she never did. She found other very good uses of her time, though.
What is induction and how is it different than deduction?
Well, it's a different direction, basically. You can think of it that way. Induction is going from observed particulars to generalizations. Deduction is applying those generalizations to particular cases. So, once you have an inductive generalization, then you can use deductive logic to apply that generalization in a whole range of particular cases. But of course, you can't. Deduction is necessarily dependent on induction, because if you don't have the generalizations, there's no way to apply them. So induction has primacy over deduction. We have to be able to get from observed particulars to generalizations and know those generalizations are true before we can use deduction to apply them to all the cases that we're faced with. And induction, of course, is the harder of the two processes to understand. And one of the problems in epistemology, through the millennia, has been that, Aristotle laid out a theory of deduction, but he did not have a theory of induction. And no one has had an adequate theory of induction. There has been some progress through the years in the sense of describing experimental method, Mills methods, the methods of difference and agreement, and so on. And so there have been, certainly people have been using inductive reasoning very effectively, scientists in particular. But as far as being able to lay out a theory that shows exactly how it works and what the standards are for judging an inductive generalization, how we know it's true, philosophers have failed pretty miserably at that.
Why should people care about physics and the philosophic foundation on which physics is based, and how does it influence our lives today?
Oh, that's a big question. Well, in regard to the philosophic foundation, I mean, I think people who are familiar with Ayn Rand's work and Leonard Peikoff's work, I think it's pretty obvious how philosophy affects our own individual lives and the culture that we live in. I mean, obviously, the choices we make in life depend on the ethics we accept. The politics that we end up with certainly depend on all the political views that are most widespread in the culture. So that aspect of the way that philosophy impacts our lives, I think, is clear. Yeah, I think what is less clear and less widely known is the way that physics affects culture in a profound way, and I think it does. And you see this working in the positive and in the negative. The most obvious way that physics affects our lives is through the technology that it gives rise to. And everybody sees that. Obviously, all we have to do is look around, and we have CD players and TV sets and everything, MRI machines.
The computer I'm talking to you with through the phone lines. You know,
exactly.
I'm actually talking to you on a computer, and you're on a telephone, so
right.
All of that
right.
In between.
Right. And, of course, none of that existed a few hundred years ago, and it all came out of physics. So physics has had an enormous impact on everybody's life. Now, but there is a wider spread impact that I think most people miss. I'll start with an example. You know, I said earlier that Newton's system of the world, where he presented an intelligible causal universe, integrated causal universe for the first time, laid the whole foundation for modern physics and that set the whole goal of physics of coming up with universal laws. But the impact of his work went way beyond physics. The century following Newton is the century we call the Enlightenment. And in the 18th century, Western culture had an authentic respect for reason, which is, I mean, it's different than any other modern century. And the United States actually grew out of that. That respect for the individual reasoning mind led to the view that people should be free to make their own choices, live their own lives, and so the whole role of government should simply be to protect individual freedom. And I mean, that view depends crucially on a positive view of reason, which, you know, in large part came out of Newton's work. So, I mean, this is the kind of widespread cultural influence that physics can have. Now that's the positive example. The negative example is that when physicists start saying that the world is in essence unintelligible and non-causal, and then they go off into 11-dimensional space-time working out theories that are completely detached from reality, that has a very negative effect, I think. And it plays into the generally low regard for reason that we see in culture today.
Does physics promote as a foundation irrationality in other areas of culture, such as religion, art, music, etc.?
Oh, yeah. Well, we see that everywhere today. There's obviously an upswing in pop mysticism and all kinds of mystic cults. There, you can't go into the bookstore today without seeing a half dozen books on the relationship between contemporary physics and Eastern mysticism. It's everywhere now, and I wouldn't necessarily say, I'm not saying that physics, that irrational ideas in physics cause these bad ideas in art, say. I mean, they're both have the same fundamental cause, which is irrational ideas in philosophy. And then that gets translated into every specialized field, physics, art. But then there's an interplay that's set up between those fields, that that the irrationalism in one field reinforces the irrationalism in the others.
What was the underlying philosophy maintained in the Principia that Isaac Newton employed, which made him one of the most influential scientists in history?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I would say that what was really new and unique about Newton's philosophy in underlying the Principia was his use of the inductive method. I mean, even the title that he gave to his book, Mathematical Principles of Natural Philosophy. Well, he actually chose that title in part to contrast his work with that of René Descartes. René Descartes had written a very influential book on physics that was titled Principles of Philosophy. And Newton took as his main nemesis, on a philosophic level, on the level of scientific method, he took René Descartes to be his main nemesis, the guy that, in effect, he had to defeat in order for his scientific method to take over. Because Descartes was a rationalist. He believed in innate ideas. He believed that you could make deductions from these innate ideas and come to conclusions about the nature of the world around you. And so Descartes' book is full of just arbitrary theory, basically, that he deduced out of his head, with very little in the way of experiment and mathematics. And Newton came along and said, basically took the view, this is exactly the wrong way to do science. We need to throw out all this, and any conclusions we reach have to be reached by this step-by-step logical process of induction from the observational data to our scientific generalizations. And, he was the major proponent of the inductive method. And, I take him in my book as being, one of my key examples, that I use to discuss the principles of that method.
How did Newton bring about a more insightful and deeper meaning to causality as contrasted to how the Greeks understood it?
Well, I mean, Newton's system of the world was the first time that a fully integrated causal view of the universe had been put forward. So, I mean, the Greeks had made attempts along those lines, but they didn't have the right method. They didn't have the mathematical tools, and they didn't have the experimental method. So they could never come up with the causal laws that explained everything they saw around them. And so they remained slightly skeptical in regard to the possibility of arriving at such laws. I mean, part of this was, I mean, the very best of the Greek thinkers, Aristotle, there was still some residual influence of Plato. And, you know, Plato had said that the physical world was an imperfect place, so you can't expect it to be perfectly intelligible or perfectly causal. I mean, it's just got these imperfections in it. I mean, this was one of the reasons why Newton's achievement was so shocking to the world, because he's presenting this theory where you can explain everything in quantitative detail. And that was something that the Greeks didn't even envision.
What is the importance of observation as a first principle to scientific knowledge?
Well, you literally can't get off the ground without it. And anybody that tries has ended up embarrassing themselves.
Like Descartes.
Yeah, exactly. Our senses provide our only direct contact with reality. So that's where everything has to start. And if you're not starting there, then you've detached from reality and you're just letting your imagination run wild and deducing consequences from made-up ideas, which is surprisingly common, not only today, I mean, it's dominant today, but it is, it's very common in history, and it was even very common in the 17th century prior to Newton. I cover a couple of examples of that in my book, where I talk about the ideas that people had come up with in regard to the relationship between white light and colored light. And the way Newton came along, threw out all those theories that had just been made up, and started with the observations, and proceeded step by step, and came to the correct theory.
You know, it always blows my mind how many people will take, you know, you get an idea on something, and then they automatically take that idea as accepted fact, rather than taking that idea as the first step in a logical process to discover the truth. You know, I just had this idea, now what can I do to verify it? And you'll hear people say things like, oh, you know, well, my mother got a funny feeling about this guy when she saw him on TV, so therefore it's fact. It's like, you know, what steps do you take to verify that this funny feeling is fact? And, you know, people really need to see that funny feeling as the first step of a logical process to discovering truth, not the final result.
Right. But, I mean, Newton even went a step further and said that the funny feeling, if you can't identify, like, the observational evidence that you have in in support of that idea, then the right thing to do is simply to dismiss the idea. It's hard to make this clear without giving specific examples, but Descartes came up with a theory for how colored light was related to white light, and he thought that light was a certain kind of particle, and then it became colored when the particle started rotating. Okay, now, there's a couple of ways, possible ways to react to that. A scientist could come along and say, well, boy, Descartes sure didn't give me much evidence for this idea. What experiments could I possibly design to try and test it? Well, I mean, that was not Newton's reaction. Newton said, well, Descartes gave no evidence for this idea, so I'm not even going to waste my time thinking about it.
Right.
I mean, he just dismissed it out of hand, which I think is that's one of the crucial principles of scientific method that Isaac Newton introduced for the first time. This rejection of arbitrary ideas.
Utter rejection, for that matter.
Yeah. I mean, it's otherwise you end up wasting your time chasing Descartes' imagination, basically. And there are better things for a scientist to do with his time.
What are first level generalizations?
Okay, I cover that in chapter one of my book. The basic idea here is, in order to get off the ground in cognition and lay a basis for knowledge, we need certain self-evident, first-level generalizations to start with. And let me give an example. A toddler is on the floor, and he reaches out and pushes this ball that he has, and he sees it roll away. And he grasps, well, pushing a ball makes it roll. Now, that is not a generalization where he needs to observe 100 different instances and then do some complicated logical process of generalizing. No, I mean, there in that kind of a simple case involving first-level concepts like, you know, ball, pushing, rolling, you can grasp it on the basis of one instance. He knows that his pushing made the ball roll. I mean, he has a direct experience of that causal connection. And in the logical leap, it's argued in chapter one that this is the foundation of our knowledge of causality. And this is what allows us to get the process started and start building up generalizations. At a first level, there are first level causal connections that are grasped directly. I mean, it's much the same way as there's an exact parallel here with Ayn Rand's theory of concepts. She made the point that a concept like ball, for instance, is first level. Like table, chair, we don't need prior concepts in order to grasp those concepts. We grasp them directly on the basis of the similarities and differences that are given in perception. And there's a parallel to that in generalizations, that first level generalizations are grasped directly. There's a whole discussion of that in chapter one of my book.
How were the discoveries of new phenomena through observation hindered by the belief in arbitrary theories? And how does that affect our understanding today in its relation to certainty and a knowable reality?
Oh, well, this was one of Newton's points, too. This was another reason why Newton simply rejected the arbitrary the way he did. One of the things he pointed out was, if you accept arbitrary conclusions, I mean, the kinds of ideas that Descartes came up with, then there is no way to reach certainty or validate any theory. And the reason is that you can always come up with arbitrary hypotheses that will contradict the theory or contradict your generalization. So if we accept the idea as a valid part of scientific method that we're free just to make up ideas from the resources of our imagination, and then those ideas, you know, have to be tested, well, that immediately leads you to skepticism, because there's no generalization in science. I mean, no matter how well-founded, no matter how much evidence there is in support of it, that somebody couldn't make up some arbitrary hypothesis that would contradict it. And if we say, well, any arbitrary hypothesis is possible, then immediately there's no such thing as certainty and there's no such thing as knowledge. So, I mean, Newton actually made exactly that point in connection with arguing for his theory of colors.
What was Newton's view of hypothesis, or what does it mean to dismiss the arbitrary?
Oh, well, it means everything has to come from sense data and then, I mean, from perception. And be grounded in observational evidence every step of the way. Now, you certainly don't have to start with an idea that that you have a lot of evidence for, but you need some evidence that at least gives rise to a certain question. And then you design the correct experiments and that hopefully can definitively answer that question. What Newton was really against was this idea that you're free just to make up these fundamental ideas and then deduce consequences, and that's the way science is done. In other words, what Newton was arguing against is exactly the way most people describe scientific method today. I mean, this hypothetical-deductive method, where you make up a hypothesis and then you design ways to test it. That was a dead end in science that leads to skepticism. That was basically his view, and I strongly support him in that view in my book.
Let's go back to David Hume. How did he lay the foundations for Immanuel Kant's philosophy?
Oh, well, what Hume did was he came along and he showed that a lot of these premises that had been argued for by previous philosophers, including Locke and Berkeley, and if you take those premises seriously, in other words, you take this idea that what we get with our senses is a stream of disconnected sensations, And then you take the idea of what concepts are and, I mean, you say that concepts are just arbitrary groupings of those sensations, you know, that we make on the basis of convenience. In other words, extreme nominalism in regard to concepts and sensationalism in regard to the senses. Now, you take those premises, and Hume says, well, what can we deduce from this? And basically, he deduces complete skepticism. We can't know anything. I mean, in essence, what he's done is he's basically said that we have the cognitive faculties of a snail, and then he deduces the obvious conclusion that we can't know anything, or at least we can't know any more than snails.
If anyone lived in the universe described by Hume, would he even be able to ask the question why?
No, there is no why in Hume's universe, because there's just one sensation after another. So
no, why is the sky blue? None of the basic questions that even a small child asks.
Right. No, even the all there are brute facts in Hume's universe. Since there is no causality and there is no logical process of induction, of reaching generalizations, I mean, you can't ask why. It's just, it's basically the snail mentality, you know, cold, yeah.
It's ironic that a small child sees enough relation between things to ask a question like why, when Hume laid an entire philosophy against such a notion in the first place. It even, you know, it goes against even infantile logic, you know, toddler
logic.
Well,
yeah, but the fact is that the child is getting much more in the way of information from the world than Hume admitted that he was getting. I mean, a child looks around. First of all, he doesn't see a disconnected stream of sensations. I mean, his experience of the world isn't anything like that. He sees a world of entities around him. And then, I mean, he's constantly grasping causal relationships among those entities and their actions. Hume said that was impossible, but, I mean, every four-year-old does it every day of his life. So
I have one. I know that perfectly well.
So, I mean, what happened was, now, this was regarded as a disaster in philosophy. Hume basically, I mean, the power of Hume's philosophy was that he took premises that a lot of other philosophers accepted. But Hume was, I give him credit for this, he was an intelligent enough guy and a good enough philosopher. So he saw the implications of those premises in much more depth than the people that had come before him. So, I mean, he showed the kind of total bankruptcy, I mean, skepticism, that those premises led to. And, I mean, it was regarded as a disaster, and most people in the 18th century actually found Hume's philosophy to be completely repugnant. Now Kant comes along, and Kant basically, I mean, at one point Kant said that Hume woke him from his slumber. And Kant takes this problem that Hume has left him, you know, as basically his starting point. And he says, well, how can I fix this situation? The I mean, we can't live like this. We can't live with this idea that human beings can know nothing of, and we can't function. Now, Kant accepted Hume's conclusion that we can't know anything about a real world around us. Kant decided to fix the problem by saying, well, we don't need to. What we're really aware of is a world of appearances created by our minds. And that's the world we experience, and that's the only world we need to deal with. So, now that world is not reality. We can't know anything about an external world independent of us. But we don't deal with such a world. We just deal with this subjective world of our own creation, and our minds create it in a certain way. And so, you know, because we're making it, you know, we're not, in effect, what Kant says is we're not the discoverers of the world. We're the authors of the laws of the world. He makes causality into a rule of the mind of how we construct the appearances. So obviously the world has to be causal for Kant, because, I mean, we're making it that way.
And as you refer to in your book, anthropocentric delusions.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. I mean, the world becomes this subjective human delusion. But Kant says that's okay, because that's the world we deal with. So he basically takes Hume's shattered universe and he puts it back together. But he puts it back together in a completely subjective way, where now suddenly the world that scientists are supposed to be investigating is not the real external world. It's this human delusion.
Wow. All right, so what was Kant's Copernican revolution, and how did this contrast with the actual Copernican revolution?
Yeah, well, what I said, that's the essence of it. Kant says, you know, at the outset of the Critique of Pure Reason, that, okay, philosophy has had a great deal of trouble figuring out how our minds can, you know, conform to reality. I mean, how we can know the truth about reality. How we can establish a correspondence between our ideas and the real things out there. And Kant says, well, the reason we've had so much trouble is because that's the wrong question. So I'm going to turn the entire question around, he says. Rather than saying that our ideas have to conform to reality, I'm going to say that reality has to conform to our ideas. And that was his Copernican revolution.
That now, sounds like that that video that came out a few years ago, the video in the book, The Secret.
Oh. Wait, I don't think I'm familiar with that.
Oh, you don't want to be then. Never mind.
Okay. Okay. I'll take your word for that. Now, you asked about, well, how is Kant's Copernican revolution different than the actual Copernican revolution? Well, it is the opposite, in fact. The way that scientists actually discovered the correct theory of the solar system. And then that culminated in Newton's physics, was by taking the exact opposite of the view that, that Kant is recommending here. The older skeptics prior to the scientific revolution, they actually recommended this viewpoint that, well, we should just content ourselves with describing the appearances because we don't really know the reality. I mean, that was one of the arguments that had been used to sustain Ptolemy's theory of the solar system. Because, well, we don't know what the real nature of these entities is and what their real motions are, but we can describe the appearances with these epicycles and equipoints and so on, and that's good enough. That's all we can hope for. Well, you know, what happened with Copernicus, Galileo, Kepler, is they explicitly threw out that idea. Galileo comes right out and says he's not interested in appearances, he's interested in reality. And what he's trying to do is discover the true nature of the universe. And, Kepler said the same thing. So, by taking the exact opposite of Kant's view is what actually led to the scientific revolution. And then Kant comes along and tries to grab the prestige of that revolution and call his reversion to skepticism his Copernican revolution. It's really disgusting.
How does Kant replace the question what with the question how?
Well, everything for Kant is our mental processes. There isn't a what out there. The what would be, the world of things around us. Well, that doesn't have anything to do with cognition as far as Kant is concerned. All that matters is our own mental processes, how our minds work. How our minds work actually determine, how the world that we create, which supposedly is the world we experience. So everything is how. And interestingly, he does the same thing in his physics. It's basic to his philosophy that, consciousness, which is an activity, creates the objects. So activity is actually has primacy in his philosophy over entities. Now, the same thing is true in his physics. He actually replaced physical entities with forces. So he had this strange theory where what we call things are in fact just point sources of force. So force has complete primacy over action in his physics as well. Primacy over things, excuse me.
What did Kant mean by physics only being the mathematics of appearances?
There only is this world of appearance, according to Kant. And so that's the only thing that science can deal with, is this phenomenal world of appearances that we create in our by the nature of our minds. Now, so given the fact that there isn't an external reality out there that is what it is, independent of us, and that we're investigating and trying to understand, if there really is just the world that we see that has been created by our minds, that gives rise to a whole different approach to physics. And, I mean, you can easily see some of the obvious implications. For example, the atomic theory of matter is out, right? It doesn't make any sense on Kant's view because atoms don't appear, right? I mean, we don't see atoms. So if all we're supposed to be doing in science is describing these appearances, then, I mean, the best we can hope to do is try to describe them, you know, as in as detailed and quantitative way as we can. So Kant was very, he was certainly in favor of mathematics, but mathematics applied to what we actually see, the appearances.
That reminds me, David, let me interrupt you real quick. That reminds me of something funny, is that statement, if a cat is made of colorless atoms, then the cat must be colorless, right? Based on appearances, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, Kant would say, you know, what are you even doing talking about atoms? I mean, you're trying to, Kant's view, was that the atomic theory was fundamentally misguided, because what scientists were trying to do was, you know, investigate and reach conclusions about the internal constitution of things that is not given in perception. Okay, so it's not part of this world of appearances at all. And somehow these scientists think they can investigate, you know, the ultimate reality that we don't see. And Kant says that's not even a part of science, a legitimate part of science. That just has to be thrown out. So, I mean, it's very, it's interesting what happened in history, because, you know, right after Kant published these views is when scientists started making, like, really important discoveries supporting the atomic theory of matter. And then there was this whole conflict that went on throughout the 19th century, that there was a tremendous accumulation of evidence in favor of the atomic composition of matter. But there were also all of these physicists and chemists that were rejecting atoms basically because of Kantian philosophy.
Do you know the proper pronunciation of Kant in German?
Oh, no, I've always just said Kant.
Okay. All right, what is Kant's take on causality?
Oh, well, I mean, causality for him is one of his categories, mental categories by which we construct the phenomenal world. So causality is not a relationship between a thing and its actions. Rather, it is an innate rule of the mind that we use in order to create the world that we see. So that is, that is a very different view of causality. It makes it completely subjective, and, you know, it's actually a small step from there to throwing out causality altogether, which is what some later positivists did.
Indeed. All right. So what is Kant's idea of deducing physics from the categories?
Oh, well, this is, this is a part of Kant's work, actually, that I think academic Kantians try to sweep under the rug today, because it is embarrassing. At particularly late in Kant's life, he started following this basic idea of his further into physics. And, you know, he realized that, well, you know, if I'm going to say that we create the phenomenal world by means of these categories, these mental categories, then we should be able to deduce from those categories the nature of the world. And so he tried to do this. I mean, he tried to actually deduce the various laws of physics and the specific properties of materials and so on from his categories. So at one point sort of made fun of Newton for doing experiments. You know, he says, you know, Newton just wasn't confident enough to reach these conclusions without the experiments. But basically Kant's implication is, why should you have to do experiments? I mean, if we know these categories, we can just deduce physics from them.
Which leads right into my next question. How did Kant's philosophy affect German physics in the early 19th century during the Romantic period? And in particular, why were physicists opposed to Newton and sick of causality?
Yeah, well, that is another interesting story that isn't given, you know, so much weight today in intellectual history, because again, it's somewhat embarrassing, I think, for the Kantians and the Romantics. What happened after Kant was, well, first, Kant became very popular in Germany very quickly. They started teaching Kant's philosophy, you know, very enthusiastically at University of Jena in the 1790s. And that became a hotbed for radical Kantianism. Now, what happened in the immediate aftermath of Kant's critiques was, I mean, there were certain objections to Kant's philosophy that his followers made. And the first objection was that Kant had talked about two worlds: the phenomenal world, which is this world of subjective appearance that we actually experience, and then the noumenal world, which is the world of things in themselves. Okay, but that was unknowable. Well, so, I mean, one of the most obvious objections you can make to Kant's philosophy at the outset is, why are we talking about something that you say is unknowable? I mean, if it's unknowable, you can't say anything about it. So why not just throw it out? So that's the first thing that Kant's followers did. They threw out the noumenal world. So there is no reality out there. There are no things in themselves. There is only this mental world, basically. There's only consciousness and the subjective, and we create the world we experience. Now, the second thing that the Romantics did was, you know, Kant had put a certain amount of emphasis on emotion, certainly when he talked about ethics. Kant's ultimate argument for his altruistic ethics was that we feel our duties. Okay, we just know what it is our moral duty to do. And these feelings are lead us to the truth. Well, the Romantics basically got rid of the noumenal world, got rid of what was left of reality, and then put a whole bunch more emphasis on the will and the emotion. And so you're left with a philosophy that is where there's nothing but consciousness left and emotionalism. Basically, Romanticism is a temper tantrum. It's roughly the way I describe it is it's basically a spoiled child rebelling against reason and reality. And this movement actually took over philosophy and science in Germany in the early decades of the 19th century. And the approach to science was this continuation of what Kant had started, that we can simply start from what we find in our heads and deduce the nature of the world. And it was an utter disaster. In fact, later in the 19th century, one of the great German scientists, Hermann Helmholtz, he wrote a paper on the Romantic movement just describing it as, an embarrassment to Germany, that all these intellectuals were publishing all these scientific ideas that that were purely arbitrary.
What made Ludwig Boltzmann the last pillar of classical physics?
Oh, that's a very interesting story. I cover that in my lecture series, The Philosophic Corruption of Physics. Boltzmann was one of the leading advocates of the atomic theory in the late 19th century. And in fact, he was the discoverer of the atomic explanation for the law of entropy. And he was really the founder of the statistical thermodynamics, the atomic theory of gases. And brilliant physicist. And very, very committed to, the old style of doing physics, sort of a more Newtonian style. Although, certainly he was making breakthrough new discoveries. He was a very original thinker. But he was opposed by the positivists who were actually dominant in the late 19th century. People like Ernst Mach, who completely rejected the atomic theory as unscientific because it was trying to reach some fundamental causal explanation that went beyond the appearances. So Boltzmann is actually a sad case because he was making these terrific discoveries, and he was basically shunned by the physics community of his time because he was so out of step. They were going in the direction of physics as, mathematical description of appearances, and he was on the old premise of trying to discover fundamental causes based on the evidence. And he was, so I mean, he was very strongly criticized for his work in the last couple of decades of the 19th century. And he became, you know, increasingly depressed about that. His nickname, as you mentioned, was actually the Last Pillar. So he was recognized as the last of the great classical physicists. And the positivists basically admitted that they were trying to tear down that structure. And he was the last one holding it up. So that's the reason for that nickname.
All right, so why did Boltzmann commit suicide, and why do historians believe that Boltzmann prevailed over Mach?
Oh, yeah, I mean, Boltzmann committed suicide in 1906. And, I mean, I'm sure there were other contributing factors in that suicide. So I'm not saying the intellectual opposition that he encountered is the whole explanation, but I certainly think it's an important part of the explanation. Boltzmann was very explicit in his writings about being depressed that physics was going in this new direction. And that the atomic theory of gases that he had spent most of his life working on seemed to be rejected, and people, his fellow physicists were telling them, well, of course, there's no way that we can say that atoms are real. You know, the most we could possibly say is that this theory is convenient in some respects. And I think that Boltzmann was clearly very depressed about his feeling isolated and alienated from his fellow physicists because he was following a very different philosophy. And that played a part in his finally committing suicide in 1906. Now, I mean, the interesting thing is that right around that time is when most physicists gave up their opposition to the atomic theory. And, I mean, what happened historically was that opposition to the atomic theory started becoming increasingly ridiculous. Rutherford had discovered the nucleus. They were doing experiments on electrons. They were starting to discover atomic structure. And the atomic theory had explained so much that it simply became ridiculous to reject the theory. In fact, all the physicists who weren't working with the atomic theory also weren't making any progress. I mean, anybody that was making progress was working with the atomic theory. So, you know, at a certain point, physicists just gave up the opposition in part on practical grounds. So that explains why. And, you know, it's often said that, oh, you know, it's too bad Boltzmann, you know, killed himself just as he won and just as he triumphed over Mach. But that triumph was limited to certain practical issues of physics, not underlying philosophy. And in fact, Mach won the philosophic battle, and physicists certainly did not adopt adopt this view that, well, reality is fully real. We can't understand it by the methods that we have been investigating it for the last couple of hundred years. They certainly didn't adopt that view. So Mach won the underlying philosophic battle, and Boltzmann won the specific battle in regard to use of the atomic theory.
To what philosophy did Einstein adhere when formulating his theory on general relativity?
Oh, well, now Einstein is a interesting case because he had a somewhat of a philosophic transition in his career. He began his formulation of special relativity. I mean, that was his first publication on that was 1905. Well, at that stage, he was strongly influenced by Mach, so he had been influenced by positivism. Later, Einstein explicitly rejected positivism, and Einstein was never cut out to be a positivist. It's much too concrete-bound empiricist philosophy. And Einstein had a very abstract mind, and he was actually more of a rationalist. I think one way, perhaps the best way to characterize Einstein's deeper philosophy is he was once asked who his favorite philosopher was in history. And his answer was Spinoza. Now Spinoza was a rationalist, and much, Spinoza's weakness as a philosopher was that he tended to work in terms of floating abstractions that were not clearly related to observed particulars, and then deduce things from those floating abstractions. I mean, that's what I mean by rationalism in the history of philosophy. Well, there's certainly some of that in Einstein, and it doesn't surprise me at all that Einstein would name Spinoza as his favorite philosopher. And the truth is, you could do a lot worse. Spinoza has his problems, but he also has his good points. And certainly, I look much more favorably on someone that tells me that Spinoza is their favorite philosopher versus, you know, if they tell me that Hume or Kant is their favorite philosopher.
Have you ever heard of the book, The Manufacture and Sale of Saint Einstein?
No, I haven't.
What basis is there to Einstein's relativity theory today?
Oh, well, I mean, on the one hand, there's a tremendous basis for it. I mean, it's I think the basic mathematical formalism is correct. It's certainly been borne out by many, many, many experiments. The question is more, how do you interpret that mathematical formalism? And that is a question that I don't think has been adequately answered. One of the books that I want to write one of these days is to really give a full answer to the kind of question that you just asked, both for relativity theory and quantum mechanics. And the way I would approach the writing of such a book would be to start out presenting those theories straight. In other words, what can you actually get from the observational evidence? And how far does that take you? And you know, how does the basic mathematical formalism of those theories, relativity and quantum mechanics, how is it induced properly from the observational evidence? And then what, you know, what conclusions actually follow from that? And what you find in the case of relativity and quantum mechanics is, you know, yes, you can get the mathematical formalism. What you can't get is the theoretical interpretations. I mean, you can't get to, I think, Einstein's theory of space-time. The idea that space curves and contracts and time dilates and that is an interpretation of the equations that doesn't in fact, you know, follow from the observations. Now, of course, even Einstein admitted this in some of his writings. Einstein wavered, actually, on his interpretation of relativity theory. And he even actually made statements in the 1920s that, well, you don't really have to throw out the idea of an ether, of some kind of physical medium. He says it just puts limitations on what kinds of properties that medium can have. So Einstein was aware of the fact that there are issues of theoretical interpretation involved in relativity theory that are still very debatable. And then quantum mechanics is a whole other kettle of fish there, but again, I mean, what they have in common is that the basic mathematical formalism of quantum mechanics has proven correct, but that certainly does not support Bohr and Heisenberg's interpretation of it.
Is there a problem with Einstein's E equals mc squared?
Well, it is, again, an issue of interpretation. I don't see any justification for the concept of relativistic mass. I think that the way that the concept mass enters into physics in any kind of important sense is what physicists call rest mass. And Einstein's basic equations for energy and momentum are certainly correct, but if I were writing a textbook presenting this material, I would certainly just stick to using rest mass and write out the rest of the equation. Saying that the mass actually increases when something moves is, there's no real reason for that. The observations, what we're actually measuring all the time is simply energy and momentum. So those equations change in relativity theory, but there's no reason to lump that in with mass.
How is Neo-Kantian philosophy differing from that of Kant in the realm of choice, and why did Einstein need this philosophy being a theoretician? And how does that contrast with Mach?
Well, Einstein, there's certainly Neo-Kantian elements in Einstein's philosophic writings. Now, there's no way that Einstein could be happy in the long run taking a Machian-type view, the positivist view, because, you know, the positivists wanted to restrict themselves to the appearances. And there's no way that Einstein was going to follow that for very long, because he was, above all, a theoretician. And he thought at a very abstract level, and he certainly was not going to restrict himself from thinking about things that he couldn't see. I mean, like atoms. I mean, Einstein made tremendous progress on, you know, atomic theory and quantum theory. The kind of restrictions on questions that the positivists insisted on, that those restrictions were intolerable to Einstein. So there's no way he could follow them. Unfortunately, he was certainly influenced by a lot of the philosophic premises in Hume and Kant, which made his philosophy made him make crucial concessions to a sort of primacy of consciousness philosophy, which I do think hurt him in a number of ways. It certainly hurt him in his debates about the proper interpretation of quantum theory.
Even though Einstein agreed with Kant's metaphysics and subjectivism, what's the importance to his legacy that he maintained the phenomenal world as still ordered, lawful, and therefore intelligible?
Right. No, I mean, I think that, I mean, it is crucially important that Einstein was completely unwilling to go along with Bohr and Heisenberg in their interpretation of the quantum world as basically non-causal, unintelligible, random. Einstein did never believe that, and always wanted to develop the quantum theory in a way that one could understand it in a causal deterministic fashion. Now, this is what I was saying a couple minutes ago. Unfortunately, Einstein's arguments weren't always very strong, and he made concessions to his philosophic opponents that he shouldn't have made. And you can see this even in some of his famous statements regarding the quantum theory. I mean, when asked why he was rejecting the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics, one of the famous statements Einstein made was, "God doesn't play dice." Well, obviously, if that's your argument, that's a weak argument. If you're trying to support a rational approach to physics, the first word out of your mouth should not be God. So that Einstein's, in this case, in this particular case, in regard to his debate with Niels Bohr on quantum theory, Einstein's heart was in the right place, but his level of philosophic understanding was not enough to for him to win that debate.
Why did Einstein agree with Mach that discoveries cannot be induced from experience, and how did this lead Einstein to rejecting the inductive method in science?
And this concludes part one of my interview with David Harriman, and we'll pick it up right where we left off next week with part two.